Chapter 32. On the second day of his new job, Hank called in sick. He was immediately fired. "They don't believe that I'm sick, then I don't want to work for them," he told Jolie. At first, she didn't answer. Then she said, "You can get a job like that anywhere." She thought about the amount of money she could make in a good week at the club. It made her feel superior to know that she was worth more on the open market than he was. "I'm going to take a ride down and see Ron." "What for?" "He called last night and asked me if I would," Hank said. "Do you want to lie down for a little while first?" "That would be good," said Hank. She got up and he followed her into the bedroom. Hank rode on the pleasurable sensation that he had satisfied her needs all the way down to Ron's house. He smoked a cigarette and settled into the comfort of driving. Alternately, he stared at the road and the way the sunlight was streaming in through the trees. The radio was playing nothing but Neil Young since he'd been in the car. Hank was floating on the music. He liked it when he didn't have to say anything. The emptiness in the next seat felt as good as the sunshine. He could look in that direction without having to be careful of what was on his face. Marjorie and Chipper answered the door. Chipper cried, wagged his tail, and peed on the hallway carpet. "Jesus Christ," said Marjorie. "That dog pissed all over the hall." "Excuse me, Hank. What a way to be greeted," he smiled and then grimaced when he saw a few drops on the tops of his shoes. Chipper had slunk away at the sound of Jesus Christ and had gone to let Ron know that Hank was here. Ron was spread across the Sunday paper, which was spread across the bed. He hadn't expected to be seeing Hank without hearing from him. Marjorie showed Hank into Ron's room. "Look at this place. Aren't you ashamed of yourself?" "No," said Ron quickly. "Hey, man, how are you doing? I thought you'd call. Didn't you have to go to work?"
"I just came down instead," said Hank.
"Look at that paper," said Marjorie. "How is anybody supposed to read the thing now?" "I'll put it back together when I'm done." "Are you staying home for dinner?"
"No."
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know."
"That's very nice," said Marjorie, walking out of the room and closing the door sharply for emphasis.
"Do you want to get fucked up?" said Ron.
Hank bobbed his head. "That would be really good." "I'll roll up some joints, and we'll head out on the road. It wouldn't be good to smoke here during the daytime with them home." He noticed that Hank was still standing by the door.
"Sit down, man. I'll put some music on. It'll take me a few minutes to get things together here, anyway."
The easy chair in the corner of Ron's room was piled high with a stack of books and papers. It seemed odd to be finding these things at Ron's house. Hank picked up the stack and put it on the floor. "How's school?" it asked.
"It blows me away. I can't believe it. I've been made the managing editor of the student newspaper, The Commuter. And it's strange, man. All of a sudden, I can do whatever I want with this newspaper."
Hank wasn't expecting this.
He'd read his college's newspaper about a half a dozen times in the 2 years he'd been there. He thought that it was all bullshit stories about civil rights and cafeteria food.
Ron showed him the issue with his latest article in it. Hank looked at the paper. It was a 16-page tabloid. He turned to Ron's article. It was a 4-paragraph opinion piece about the 18-year-old vote being turned down. It began, "Once again, the intelligent voters of New Jersey have shown their ignorance by keeping the rightful act of voting out of the hands of the people who have to fight their stinking war." Hank started to say that Ron had spelled intelligent incorrectly, but he kept it to himself and scanned the rest of the essay. It ended with, "If they won't let us take part in the making of the laws, then I say, why should we bother to obey?"
They're sick things that are only evidence of how screwed up they are anyway. Hank didn't know what to think about it. Had never thought that voting would change his life. If he had, he would have started paying attention to all the rest of the stuff that the government was inflicting on everyone, everywhere. He didn't want to think about it. It was always fucked up. Governments had always caused wars. Hank decided that in his 10th grade history class, and nothing had come along since then to change his mind. The only thing to do was to stay out of their way and not let them get their hands on you. "This is really incredible," he said to Ron. "You like it, huh?" Ron was standing there watching Hank read his article. It occurred to him at several points that Hank didn't seem to be reading that much, but maybe he was just thinking about what he was reading. "I guess you didn't read the other two that I wrote either, huh?" said Ron, suddenly scouring the room for the back issues of the paper. "I think you're sitting on them." Hank, who was leaning back, but sat forward and reached under himself. "A pile of things you had in the chair here." Ron dropped to his knees and sorted through the stack. "They're not here," he said, looking up in dismay. "Was one of them about the fraternities?" "Yeah." "Did that one come out before you ran away with Joe Lee?" "I don't remember," said Hank. "Right about the same time, I think." Hank wondered what Joe Lee might be doing, and wondered why he left her alone. The answer hit him as suddenly as something Ron would say without thinking. To get away from her. Ron sat down on the floor, took out his pot cleaning tray. "So what's it like to live with her?" "It's really something," said Hank. "She's making you lose weight, huh?" said Ron. "She sure is." "I can't believe it, man. It all happened so fast, you know?" "I guess it did. It seemed to Hank like it had been going on forever." "Does everybody still think that you're married?" "I guess so. My mother said that a lot of them aren't sending gifts because they weren't invited to the wedding, though. She said that it cost her part of the family, but that was okay because she didn't care much for them anyway." "Does she believe you're married?" "It's hard to say. The other day my father asked to see my marriage license." "What did you say?" "I said, sure. And I'll keep saying that. Eventually he'll drop it." "How's the job?" "It sucked. I quit." "That didn't take long." Ron remembered with a swollen chest sense of pride the jobs he'd stayed at in order to get money. He stayed at IBM a full year after he knew it wasn't for him. He wondered if Hank would ever learn to do things that needed doing. He thought that Hank was just lazy, because it had always been so easy. "Are your folks still giving you money?" "Sure, every week." "Let's get out of here," said Ron. He was feeling the pressure of having people in the next room. He wanted to get a container of coffee, smoke the joints he'd rolled. He lit the first joint as soon as they got in the car. "You're not even going to wait until we're off the block, huh?" "I'm not waiting for nothing," said Ron. Hank took the familiar route to the loop. It wasn't quite as comfortable during the day as it was at night, but the principle was the same. You could pretty much drive nonstop without going anywhere. They passed the joint down by the gear shift, and each kept a cigarette lit. "Did you really like the article, or were you just putting me on?" "No, it was good." "You don't think that it matters about words being misspelled?" "No," said Hank. "I could tell what they were supposed to mean." "That's what I figure," felt. Ron felt like his suspicion with grammar was for English teachers and had been confirmed. "This guy Lashley has really been fucking with my head. I wanted to show you the letter he wrote me. It's like I got every word of it burned into my brain." "You don't have to bother to listening to anything they say," Just get the grade and get out. Not this time, said Ron. Whatever he's got to say, I want him to hit me with it, whenever he wants. Pretty soon, I'm going to go right for his jugular, and I won't feel too bad if he got his shots in too. Hank puffed the joint as he drove along the northern border of the loop. I really didn't miss this stuff. It sure is nice. I do believe I could get hooked on it, said Ron. But it's okay, because you can take a vacation from it whenever you like. He lowered his voice to this. It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are, imitation? Until it leads to harder drugs. He paused dramatically. Like tobacco, alcohol, and caffeine. Which is where it's just led me. He puffed greedily on the cigarette to complete the effect. Do you want to get some coffee to ride around with? Sure, said Hank. They stopped at a 7-Eleven and each got a large container. These places are like munchy heaven, said Ron. Designed with the mass consumption pothead in mind. They know how to get you at every turn, said Hank. I met this girl, said Ron. Hank didn't answer. I think she's going to be around for a while. What's her name? Rolling his R's, Ron said, Rebecca Rinelli. Rebecca Rinelli, repeated Hank for emphasis. You want to drive over to Wellmont and see if Quimpy is around? Do you want to take a ride up through the reservation? Not especially. Well, what do you feel like doing? I don't know, Hank said with sarcastic pith in his voice. Hey man, I don't really give a fuck what we do. You know, up to you. It's up to me, repeated Hank with a grimace that spread down through his arms to the walnut bulb, which he jerked into the downshift. We could just smoke this last joint and ride back to my house and listen to some music. That would be okay, said Hank, thinking that it brought him one step closer to having the seat next to him empty again. As they passed the joint, Hank got them back to Ron's house quickly. When they got to his room, they found Marjorie stripping the bed and cleaning out the room. She was surprised to see them back so soon. As long as your room is in my house, I'm going to do my best to see that I don't have bugs, she said. Ron paced through the rooms like a penned animal. He couldn't believe that had he put up with somebody deciding when it was time to clean his things. He strode back into his room. Look, he said to Hank, I can't stay here, and there's really nothing that you want to do. So I guess that I'm just going to go up to Wellmont and hang out. I guess that I better be going, said Hank. He didn't want to arrive at the apartment before Joe Lee left for work. He sat down in Ron's room to contemplate the problem. Ron stared at him. Marjorie said, I guess I'll have to leave this right in the middle. Ron glared at her. I'll do it. When? She said, turning for the door. In 6 months? They sat in his room without saying anything for a long time. Do you want to hear some music before you go? Said Ron. Not really. Ron gave him a look of exasperation. Hank stood up. I think I'll go over to my parents' house and pick up some money before I head back. He started to walk and realized that his foot had fallen asleep. Hank set his jaw in a determined way. He looked like Bela Lugosi as he limped out of the room. Chipper trotted over to say goodbye. The tingling was jumping up his leg like a short circuit. Hank said, so long to Marjorie, with a jovial difficulty. Ron called Rebecca, but there was no answer. He decided to do some homework, opened his lit book to the section that had the Inferno in it. He read the first few lines and didn't understand them. He read them again. They didn't seem any clearer. Then he went again to call Rebecca. Still no answer. Back in his room, he wondered if college textbooks were designed to be harder as you went along. He started the first page for the third time. He told himself that he did understand and ignored the confused messages from his brain. Some hours later, Rebecca picked up the phone on the first ring. "Hi," said Ron. "I was wondering if I was going to miss your call," she answered. "This is the first time I tried to get you," he said. "Anyway, would you like to get together and do something?" "I haven't done any studying all weekend," she answered. "I've been trying to do some reading myself." "It's not that I wouldn't want to see you," she said. "I could drive down and bring my books with me." "I don't think we'd get much work done." Ron smiled. She was right, and she was also telling him what she liked to do with him. "Maybe I'll see you tomorrow at school then," he said. Ron went back into his room and sat down with the book again. He skated in his other classes by just paying attention to what was being said. But he wanted to know this cold. He read it again. It was 11 p.m. by the time he'd finished the piece to his satisfaction. He was smiling. Except for a few words, he saw how it was supposed to fit together. He was too tired to be playing with the dictionary now. He was going to go to sleep, be ready for the next morning. An hour later, he was sure that he was never going to go to sleep. He turned on his light, rolled a joint, opened the window over his bed, and turned the light back off. The pot tasted better in the dark. He stared out the window. The air was getting colder each day. He blew smoke through the screen that he hadn't replaced with a slide-down storm window for just this reason, and peered into the row of hedges in his backyard. After his eyes became adjusted, they were clear. The next group of shadows was the garage. He fixed his eyes on it, waited for the details to come into focus. Footsteps in the kitchen and the opening of a refrigerator tensed his body. He froze and waited for trouble. He was sure that they knew he smoked in his room, and thought that some night they would decide it was in his best interest to call the cops and have him straightened out. He wondered what they thought of him. It couldn't be anything close to the truth. Maybe they just didn't think about what went on inside of other people, only what came out and how well it fit into their idea of things. The steps went away. He smoked the joint down 2/3 of the way and wished he was just starting it. The warm, good feeling had just filled him up, as if he was just starting. It would have been the whole joint then to look forward to. He put out the joint and began to roll another one. He wondered if he could put on the music very softly. It was too late, and he was getting stoned. He decided to compromise, turn on the radio. It was Sunday night, and the dial was virtually empty. Hoping for something he could stand to hear, Ron turned slowly from one end to the other. Bob Fass's voice put an immediate grin on his face, and a whisper filled with tonality, resonant enough to be soothing and at the same time lively enough to contain a controlled excitement. Ron had stumbled into the very first words of the show. Fass had run 20 minutes of dead air to get rid of the unwanted. He knew his regulars would understand what was happening and be patient. "Good morning, Cabal," began Fass. "It feels like it must be some decree of nature that I'm here tonight. I wasn't supposed to be here." I'm supposed to be at Woodstock. He paused to call forth the sacred image. Old Woodstock, said Fath, with a strange colony of artists and artisans and poets, and perhaps even a couple of singers. But it didn't happen. I thought it was going to happen when I went to bed last night and when I woke up. But by the time the evening that has just passed into night arrived, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt and unequivocally that it was out of the question. There was a pause. Volkswagens. He paused again. They can be looked upon as German military machine or Beatles. He pronounced this last word with a combination of respect, sadness, and snobbery. Friends of man, necessary evils, toy cars, and yes, by some, he lowered his voice to a paranoid whisper, the invasion of foreigners. Ron could almost see the look of mock shock on Fass's face. Volkswagens, Fass repeated sadly, adding with a sense of hurt, that's all I can say about it. That's all I really need to say about it. That's all my temporary state of equilibrium will allow me to say about it. This was followed by 30 seconds more of dead air. Ron moved closer to the radio. When I found myself at the station, there was, in my mailbox, left by some anonymous personage in the night, this tape. I don't know what this tape contains, but we're going to find out together. It was a woman's voice. She introduced herself as a member of the Weather Underground and went on to outline the disruptions that her organization was planning in order to topple the government of the United States. Ron listened to the tape for its full 90 minutes. The idea of bombing public buildings went against his grain. But as the night wore on, the tapes communicated the idea that the only thing America was willing to pay attention to were violent things, things that affected their comfort. As long as Johnny Carson comes on every night and laughs about the good life, all's right with the world. But if Dear John was afraid of being blown up, he'd quickly change his attitude and find out what the story was. That would be of interest to him and of countless millions like him, if something was going to affect their own little island. She concluded by saying that the Weather Underground could not be contacted, could not be joined, that you couldn't write for membership and get a free t-shirt or frisbee that told you who you were. Fast returned to the air. Ron could sense mixed emotions in his voice. Fass had been a pacifist all his life. He had also been in Chicago and been beaten and arrested. He told his audience that although the ideas they'd just heard were misguided, violence was a natural reaction to being beaten. Fass put on some Dylan music, and Ron let it carry him to sleep.